becoming increasingly emboldened towards Christians because we've lost the ability or the willingness ourselves to take the fight head on. And yet the evidence for Christianity, it is so undeniable and so irrefutable that we can be absolutely sure that our faith as we gather here this morning is not in vain and that it rests on solid ground. True faith, that is, true faith. And that really begs the question that I want to begin with this morning, and the question is this: why do you believe what you believe? I mean, whether you are a Christian or whether you are a Muslim, an agnostic, an atheist, in your mind, I want you to go back to the time in your life when you first became convinced of whatever faith it is that you hold here this morning and ask yourself this question: what is my faith based on? What facts, what opinions, what influences or otherwise led you today, led me today to where I am and what it is that I believe to be the truth? And I think if we're completely honest about that, we actually might surprise ourselves with the answer. We might actually find that our faith doesn't rest as on solid of a foundation as it really needs to be. And here's what I mean by that. You know, many in the world believe simply what they believe because isn't it just what their parents taught them? I mean, from the time that we are young, our parents, according to what they thought was right, had a significant control over our influence and behavior. So suppose you have a Christian and a Muslim, and the Christian and the Muslim, they're engaged in conversation, and the Muslim asks the Christian, "Why are you a Christian?" And the Christian answers, "Well, because that's how I was raised. My mom and dad took me to church from the time that I was young, taught me the Bible from the time that I was young. We prayed before every meal, we prayed before going to bed, and all of my friends are Christians." Okay, but does that prove that Christianity is right? Could not the Muslim answer in the exact same way as that Christian? You know, Muslims, from the time that they are young, they're taking to mosque, they're taught to pray in a certain way, they are taught the Quran from their childhood, and typically make friends with other Muslims. Now, it's true that parents should try to raise their children in a faith that they deem to be the truth. Even the Bible teaches us that in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. The proverb writer says that we should train up a child in the way that he should go so that when he's old, he will not depart from it. But the point that I'm trying to make is just because a person was raised with a particular faith does not prove whether or not that is the correct faith. And if that is the only answer that I can give someone who asks of me to give an answer for the hope that is my calling, then what makes him right and me wrong, or me wrong and him right? Where's the objective evidence? We might say to that, well, his parents brought him up in the wrong faith. But see, that's what he would also say about you. Let's look at another example. Suppose it's not a Christian and a Muslim this time. Suppose it's a Christian and a Mormon, and a Christian and a Mormon are talking about their individual beliefs. And the Christian says, well, I know that Christianity is right because I've had experiences occur in my faith that cannot be otherwise explained. And the Christian, what he means by that is, I've experienced the power of prayer in my life. I've been involved in prayer services for those who are sick. I've seen them recover. A Christian might say, well, I've seen the power of the Holy Spirit at work in my life. And even when I became a Christian, I just felt the weight of sin just lift from my shoulders and the effects of it in my life. And so I know that Christianity is the right religion because of all of these experiences that I've had. But couldn't the Mormon say the exact same thing? In fact, Mormons do say the exact same thing. A Mormon will say, I know the Book of Mormon is correct, and I know that Joseph Smith is a prophet because I felt the effects of that in my life. I've seen God answer my prayers, and when I held that Book of Mormon for the first time and asked God if it were true, I felt that burning in my bosom that the Book of Mormon teaches that they experience. Now, the Christian would say that the Mormon experience is wrong, and the Mormon would say that the Christian experience is wrong. But my question is, if that is your evidence, how do you determine between the two which is right? One more example before we get to the point. Suppose that now we have a Christian and a Buddhist engaged in a discussion about their respective beliefs. A Christian and a Buddhist. And the Christian says, well, I was taught the Bible by so-and-so preacher. Perhaps you've heard of him. He's so smart and he's so eloquent and he's so kind of a person that there's just no way that what he taught me could be wrong. And add to that fact that maybe this preacher has the title of reverend or father or pastor that precedes his first name and maybe even a PhD that follows his name. But, you know, the Buddhist could say the exact same thing. The Buddhist is well acquainted with intellectuals within his realm who are not only scholars of his faith, but appear to bear the fruit of what he teaches as a Buddhist. And so the question is the same. Who's right in that situation? And if that is our best and most convincing argumentation, then why is one person more right than the other? Here's the point. Presuppositions, emotional subjectivity, and relationships do not confirm truth. And when we have an opportunity to discuss our differences with other people, if answers such as these are the best that we can provide, we're never going to know whether we are truly on the right path. And not only that, we're never going to be able to adequately defend our own faith and prove that our faith actually does rest on solid ground. The key to actually knowing the truth, brethren, will always be and has always been based on evidence. And whatever it is that I believe, whatever faith that I espouse to this morning, that I cling to with everything I've got, whatever faith that I find in my life making constant sacrifices to uphold in my life and the life of my family, I must make sure that that faith has a foundation that is based on pure, objective evidence. And what I mean by that is confirmation, proof, facts, verification. Evidence is the means by which all truths are discovered. And evidence is the means by which true faith is produced. You know, our entire judicial system in our day and age is based upon evidence. To such a degree that men and women in our judicial system are tried on capital charges in courtrooms based on evidence, even if there were no eyewitnesses present at the crime in question. Science makes its astounding discoveries based on evidence. How we make pretty much all of our decisions in life, the right decisions anyway, is based on evidence. Which car do I buy? Where do I go on vacation next year? Should I marry this person? It may be good evidence or it may be poor evidence. And our analysis of the evidence may be good or it may be bad, but we need to gather the evidence in order to make truly intelligent decisions and come to objective truth. In Matthew chapter 22 and in verse 37, Matthew 22 and verse 37, when Jesus had a chance to explain what the greatest commandment was to those who were questioning him. In Matthew 22 and verse 37, Jesus said to them that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. With all your mind. But here's the problem. Rather than using our mind, in attempting to uncover the facts and the evidence, too often we like to allow other things to override rational, thought-out conclusions, which in turn will hinder our search for truth. Now, let's just consider a few of the ways in which we can do this. First, as we briefly hit on, the temptation will always exist in our lives to cling to our biases and to cling to our prejudices. And let me say this about biases and prejudices, because I think sometimes they get a bad rap, and for the most part, I believe that's true. But actually, it's impossible to go through life without developing views that help us to navigate life. So in a sense, our presuppositions actually make it possible for us to survive in an environment that is constantly bombarding and barraging us with millions of impressions each day. What I mean is that we can't possibly deal with every single stimulus that comes our way. We have to be selective in that process so that we can concentrate on what we perceive to be important at that particular moment. But here's where the problem comes in with that. It's when valid information and valid evidence comes our way, and then we inappropriately screen out that information. That's what gets us in trouble. Our theories about what we believe to be true can become so ingrained within us that we don't recognize those theories as mere presuppositions and biases. And so we'll just assume that those theories are automatically right, even if we can't prove them. And so it's when we inspect evidence without awareness of our own personal presuppositions and biases that we can end up not treating the evidence that does come our way as objective as we need to. And so that leads me to the second point. When we allow our presuppositions about what we believe and our biases to hold us back, the second thing that this can lead to is intellectual dishonesty. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, Paul, in talking about this to the Gentiles who did not have the law of God and yet had the general revelation of God's existence and character from creation itself, said this to them in Romans 1:18. He said that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Suppress the truth. That's what I mean by intellectual dishonesty. So here's how it happens. When evidence is put before us that's worth considering, and that evidence happens to be very strong evidence, that is when, you know, I'm going to start feeling a little bit uncomfortable for how true this might be. And when that happens, when I start feeling uncomfortable, there's where the tendency comes to start to feel intellectually, or to start to be intellectually dishonest as I attempt to try to suppress this knowledge and this evidence that has come my way. And so I'll stonewall, I'll avoid it at all costs, try to pretend like it's not there. I'll go the route of the proverbial ostrich and just stick my head in the sand and hope that I just never saw this piece of evidence that just happened to come floating my way. We can refuse to answer penetrating questions that are proposed to us. We can try to change the subject. We can go as far as even to result to name calling in order to ruin the reputation of the one who is showing us this evidence. There was this one guy that I would debate with about spiritual things, and every time I backed him into a corner, he had this tactic he would use with me. Every time I backed him into a corner, he would just start laughing at me. He would just go, and the reason that he did that, other than the fact he was trying to mock me and ridicule me, is he had no answer. He had no answer, and so all he could go back to was just laughing and hoping that by laughing at me and getting me, you know, insulted or getting my feelings hurt, that maybe the argument will go away. But these are all versions of what we would call the proverbial ostrich, and that we're hoping to just sort of stick our head in the sand and just hope that the evidence goes away so that I don't have to deal with that evidence in a truthful and in an honest manner. But the problem with this is that this doesn't help me find truth. All it does is it makes me feel better about myself at the expense of having a rational and reasonable discussion that's based on the actual evidence. But then the third thing that we can do that hinders the truth is we can decide that we're going to become apathetic toward the evidence. Apathetic toward the evidence. In other words, we just decide, you know, I see the evidence, but, you know, I just really don't care, and I don't want to deal with it. We're set in our ways. It'll cost me too much to change my view, and so I'd rather just not deal with this evidence and therefore be blissfully ignorant. Sometimes this apathy can actually be disguised by the humanistic belief that there really is no right or wrong answer to begin with. Some skeptics that I've talked to have actually become rather comfortable with what they believe to be the unknowable. And so they'll argue that the fact alone that people don't agree on everything is evidence itself that no one can ever really know whether there is a God or if he exists or who he is for that matter. Now, I'll say this. There are some people in life, or some things in life, I should say, that are going to be that way, that we might not ever know, or there's going to be conflicting opinions on that. You know, there's been a debate. Well, which is best, whey protein or soy protein? I bet if I, took a tally, half of you raise your hand and say, oh, yes, whey protein. Other people are going to say soy protein. I don't know. One says one says the other, and it depends on what decade it's in that this one particular thing is popular. Which is the latest diet fad? Is it the paleo diet? Some of you guys are doing the Whole 30. 6 more months, it's going to be something else. You know, everybody's always coming out saying this is the best thing to do, and then the next day, this is the best thing to do. You know, should a baby sleep on its stomach? Should it sleep on its side? Should it sleep on its back? Well, there might be an answer to that. Probably should know that one. But, you know, there's all kinds of things like that that, you know, people are always coming out saying, this is the best way. No, this is the best way. And it changes with time. It changes with opinion. But here's the problem. You know, most of these things don't really amount to life and death decisions. Most of them. But I tell you, this does. What we're doing here absolutely does. And so the problem with this type of apathy towards spiritual things is that if that is your view about Christianity, you are potentially dealing with a life and death scenario, and not just a physical life and death scenario. You are potentially dealing with a spiritual life and death scenario. And because of the richness of evidence for Christianity, I really can't afford to at least give this evidence an honest and thorough glance before I decide that I'm just going to stop caring because there's just too many people that disagree anyway. And so the point is, whatever happens to be my belief this morning, whether it is a faith in God and a faith in the Bible or a faith that denies his existence, can I this morning personally point to objective evidence for that faith to prove that my faith in that rests on solid ground? That's the question that we need to challenge ourselves with every day. Because if you do have faith in God, and if you do have faith in the Bible, which is the case for the overwhelming majority of us here, here's the thing. The Bible itself, the book that we cling to, teaches us that evidence must be the basis of our faith. It must be. And this can be one of the most common misconceptions, both in the Christian world and in the world of the skeptic. That is incorrectly understanding what true Christian faith really is. For example, some will say, well, faith begins where reason ends. Have you ever heard that before? Faith begins where reason ends. Meaning that if I choose to believe in God, and if I choose to believe in this right here, I must do so in the absence of reason. I don't care how grand that proverb or that little saying sounds, truth begins where reason. I don't care how great that phrase sounds. That is not what the Bible teaches. It is not what the Bible teaches. And there cannot be faith without reason. Hebrews chapter 11 verse 1 that we've already looked at a couple times this morning. Hebrews 11 verse 1 says the exact opposite of this idea. Hebrews 11 verse 1 says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, the hope that he is talking about here in 11 verse 1, it's not wishful thinking. Sometimes we use hope in a wishful thinking kind of way, like, you know, the weather's been so nice at the end of this week. I sure hope it's nice next week. You know, that's wishful thinking, but it is February, so it's probably going to get back. That's wishful thinking. But the Greek word used for hope in Hebrews 11, verse 1, indicates a confident expectation in that we have good reason and good evidence to hope in something. In other words, while faith is believing in the unseen, while that is true, it is believing in the unseen because we have good, valid evidence to do so. That's what that means. When Isaiah contends with the Jews in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 18, he says, "Come and let us reason together." So does that sound like faith begins where reason ends? Absolutely not. It sounds like the exact opposite. What that means is God is the one who wants us to have a faith that is based on reason. He wants us to have confident expectation in the unseen based on the things that we can see. There's another phrase that I've heard, and this might sound more familiar to you because of who said it, but it's faith is believing what you know can't be true. You know who said that? Faith is believing what you know can't be true. Mark Twain said that. That faith is believing what you know can't be true. And I'll be honest, I have met Christians before who actually take pride in that very thing, who take pride in the fact that they believe things that they also believe at the same time are irrational, and then thinking that that kind of faith is somehow pious. That is not what the Bible teaches. In John 8 and verse 31 and 32, John 8 verse 31 and 32, Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Do you see the connection in these verses? There is a relationship between believing, between faith, and then that which is true. Faith is believing things we know are true because the objective evidence for that faith is undeniable. That's what true faith is. And then the third one that I've heard from time to time is faith is believing when common sense tells you not to. Faith is believing when common sense tells you not to. Now, this takes rationality completely out of the equation, doesn't it? As if God wants us, you know, to completely separate our minds from our faith. I love 1 John chapter 1. 1 John chapter 1, when the Apostle John writes in his first epistle about the personal experience that he had with the Son of God. Here's what he said in 1 John chapter 1. 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. The Apostle John said, "What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. And the life was manifested, and we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also." In other words, why did John believe? John believed because he saw, he heard, and he handled, he touched. He used three of his five senses to make his decision, just as every other eyewitness of that day did. And then he and everyone else who was in the best possible position to know the truth of what happened in those days then reported it back to us and then led lives of virtue and sacrifice that gives credence to their claim. This isn't believing in something when common sense tells you not to. It's the exact opposite. It's being so impressed by the strength of the evidence that you have no choice but to believe. But then the fourth thing, I've heard people say faith is unquestionable belief that doesn't require proof and evidence. I'm going to show you in the following verses that the Bible teaches the exact opposite of that view. Look with me in Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. In Acts chapter 17, when the Apostle Paul traveled the world preaching Jesus Christ, one of the first places that he would attempt to do so as he traveled from city to city was within the synagogue of the Jews. And he would go into these synagogues on the Sabbath day, and he would use the Old Testament scriptures to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, let's read verses 2 through 4 of Acts 17. And as you read Acts 17, 2 through 4, ask yourself if faith is the unquestionable belief in something that doesn't require proof and evidence. Ask yourself that question as we're reading. Verse 2, it says, according to Paul's custom, he went to them, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, this Jesus who I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas along with a large number of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. What I see from this verse is that Paul didn't teach a Christianity that was devoid of common sense and objectivity. Paul reasoned with them from Scripture by explaining the passages in the Old Testament and giving evidence for their fulfillment. And it was on that basis that these people were persuaded, and for no other reason. And so when those persuaded went out persuading others, they could likewise point to the same evidence that Paul did for why they believed what they believed, because that is what their faith at that time was based upon. Their faith was based upon evidence. And brethren, that's what our faith needs to be based upon. Look back in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Just flip one book ahead to Romans chapter 1. We've already looked at verse 18, but we'll read that and a couple other verses. Romans chapter 1. In Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 20, in the first chapter of Romans, Paul is discussing the accountability toward God of the Gentiles, that though they were a people without the law, there was sufficient general revelation for them to believe in God. And here's what he says again in verse 18. He says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. See, evident, evidence, how they come from the same word. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. The key is, from these verses, is that God has made his existence evident within them as well as throughout the creation itself, so that merely by looking at existence itself, we see the abundant evidence for God's presence. What Paul is talking about here is not blind faith in the invisible. It's understanding that there are visible signs within existence that point to the invisible, that point to the things that we cannot see. You know, going back to the illustration that I used earlier, isn't this exactly how our judicial system works? A person in our society can be convicted of murder even if there were no eyewitnesses to see him commit the murder in question. Now, someone might ask, well, how is that fair? Well, you never hear people questioning that in the judicial system, do you? Because what happens is a jury of his peers examines that evidence, the things they can see and hear and touch, and they can evaluate that evidence with their senses and try to decide whether these things that are visible to their senses are convincing enough to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt a capital crime was committed that was in fact invisible to their eyes. All I'm saying is that's how it works with faith in God. We may not see God with our eyes. I mean, who he is, like the way we're going to see him on Judgment Day. We may not see him with our eyes. We may have not lived 2,000 years ago to have seen and experienced Jesus walking the earth such as John did in 1 John chapter 1. But we do see other pieces of evidence, visible evidence, that points to the invisible. Hebrews 11, verse 3, by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. And so when a skeptic says, I refuse to believe in God unless he shows himself to me in person, buddy, you don't want that. You don't want it. Because let me tell you something. If that's going to be your first acquaintance with God, that is it for you. That's it. You don't want that to happen, because when that happens, that's what we call Judgment Day. And when Judgment Day comes, there is no more atonement ready or left over for your sin. There's none. That's it. But secondly, if a skeptic says, I'm not going to believe in God unless he shows me himself in person, ask him, is that how our judicial system works? Is that how we make all of our decisions in life? Don't we make life and death decisions based on evidence, even if we couldn't see the act itself with our own eyes? I mean, Christian dating websites are taking off, folks. You know? That's all I'm going to say about that. Yeah, but even more important than that, of course, is spiritual life and death decisions are made on the basis of visible facts that point to invisible things. And this is not far-fetched, because that's how it works in life. And, you know, here's the other thing that's so powerful to me, is that is the exact reasoning that Jesus Christ used when he was here on earth. Look in John chapter 5. John chapter 5. John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, this is how Jesus confirmed truth, his testimony. When in verse 31 of John chapter 5, he said, if I alone testify about myself, my testimony is not true. I want you to think about that. Let's read it again. Jesus himself said about himself, if I alone testify about myself, my testimony is not true. In other words, Jesus didn't come on the scene claiming these grandiose things and then followed up with, well, you're just going to have to take my word for it. And when we go out into society and we try to convince people of the truths of Christianity, we better not come from that angle as well. Because Jesus himself knew that a person's testimony in and of itself is not sufficient evidence, and so he applied that reasoning to himself. You know, our Pentecostal and charismatic friends will make claims to miracles and then expect that the claim alone should prove the validity of their claim. That they've been using that tactic for years and years and years, and they'll never stop. And the moment we ask for evidence from our Pentecostal friends, they'll say, oh, ye of little faith, despite the fact that even Jesus himself said the testimony of a person does not substantiate his claim. So then what did substantiate it? Look at in verse 36, John 5, verse 36. He said, but the testimony which I have is greater than the testimony of John, for the works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do, testify about me that the Father has sent me. In other words, the miracles he performed confirmed his testimony, because no one could do the things that Jesus did unless God had given him that ability. The miracles he performed were just too incredible. They were greater than the testimony of John the Baptist, but it also included the testimony of the Father, and it included the testimony of Scripture. All these things were the evidence that pointed to Jesus as being the Messiah. Look in John chapter 10, just a couple more verses. John chapter 10, along the same lines. John chapter 10, verse 37. John 10, verse 37 and 38, Jesus says there, if I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. Well, that's pretty bold, isn't it? If I don't do them, don't believe me. But if I do them, though you do not believe in me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. Now, previously in this chapter, Jesus has already answered their false charges of blasphemy, but now he's taking it to another level. He's saying, you know, whether I'm a blasphemer or not depends ultimately on whether I represent God or not. And to prove this, he appeals again to his works, his miracles. Are they or are they not the works of the Father? They had their Old Testaments. They had their Old Testaments, and they saw the works of the Father from those time periods in the Old Testament, and they could make a comparison. And so Jesus is asking them, do my works correspond to those works of the Father in the Old Testament, or do they not? And every honest-hearted person that was there before him knew the answer to that question. And then finally, in John chapter 20, in verse 30 and 31, John 20 and verse 30 and 31, and what is an apt epilogue of this gospel, John says in John 20, verse 30 and 31, therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. John says, I'm writing about this so you will believe. And the signs present in this letter are the evidence upon which you can measure your faith. Biblical faith, brethren, true biblical faith must be based on evidence. Or if I can just be so bold, it cannot truly be faith. At least not faith that rests on solid foundations and solid ground. So what's the point of a lesson like this? The point of this lesson is that if you're here this morning and you do not believe in God, I don't want to trick you into doing so. I don't feel like I have to trick you. I don't want to fill your mind with silliness and subjective arguments based on feeling to cause you to become a believer, because that's not the way. That's not what the Bible teaches. If you're here this morning and you don't believe in God and you're not a Christian because you don't think there is evidence, you know, for that, what I want to do is to show you the objective truths that cannot be denied, that cannot be successfully countered, to show you that there is undeniable evidence for true Christian faith. That's what I want to do. Now, we don't have time to go through all that because we'd be here for hundreds of years because the evidence is so vast. But let me say this as well. If you're here this morning and you are a Christian, and perhaps you've realized that your faith, your own personal faith, does not rest upon the objective, plausible evidence for Christianity that it really needs to be, you know, my job as a gospel preacher is to equip you with that evidence so that you can fortify your faith. And I hope I can do that for you. I hope I have done that for you as others have done it for me, because nothing will make you stronger in faith than having the actual knowledge and the evidence of that faith that leads to life. And we're here this morning to provide that in one-on-one studies and small group studies and whatever need. We don't want anybody that's here this morning who either doesn't believe in God, maybe atheists, agnostics, or whatever, or somebody that doesn't feel they have the evidence that they need to fortify that. We don't want you to ever be ashamed to come and ask, show me the truth. In fact, we accept the challenge here at this church. We're not going to fill you with silliness and subjective arguments. We've got the evidence, we've got the facts, and we're ready to answer whatever questions that you may have. If that is your need this morning, or if your need is to come and to render obedience to the gospel, then we encourage you to come forward and make it known what we can do to help you this morning as we stand and as we sing.